Hey Sam, thanks for coming on.
Hey, Jake, great to meet you and thanks for reaching out.
Yeah, so how did you get into this work?
Well, into books,
Yeah.
I've been obsessed with books my whole life. I guess from going to the library as a kid back when we still had the card catalog, I can remember the smell of rifling through the card catalog. And yeah, I would just spend a lot of time alone reading, basically. That set me up for a career in books.
So what made you want to go down the road of paraphrasing and translation and stuff like that?
It's first I after college I started working as a book designer and also began writing essays, getting them published in little magazines and websites here and there. This was around the year 2000. And also got into self-publishing my own work. And one of the first things I did actually was I was a very conservative Christian at that time in my life. And I was really interested in the teachings of Pope John Paul II. But he was very intellectual and would write things in a very difficult style. So I took a series of his sermons and rewrote them in simpler language and self-published those. So, and it had a really good reception. So that's where
Cool.
I learned I had sort of a talent for reading difficult works and then rephrasing them in an easier way for people.
Yeah. How do you go about trying to rephrase books like that? Because I mean, I will say, honestly, a big barrier for me with some of the older writers, like as smart as they are, sometimes the language just puts me off and it's just like it's tougher and I just end up not wanting to read it. So it's much more enjoyable for me when it's in more modern language that I have an easier time understanding.
I would say mainly I do it for myself. When I start out with one of these projects, I read the work, I meditate on it, and just put it in a way that's pleasing to me, using both a combination of their words and my words. So it's hard to describe how I do it, except
Yeah.
editing. It's a
Yeah.
matter of editing. It's like if I took something that I had written and was writing a second draft of it, how would I
Yeah.
change this to better communicate?
Yeah. Yeah, so the first one that I read of yours was this this Tao Te Ching, which was really good for I think especially for me as a beginner. Like, it took me, I mean, who knows how much of it I actually understand. Like the first read was a couple of years back. And I had no idea what he was talking about. And I felt like this book was really good for putting it in like as plain and like simple language as possible for a book like that. What made you want to get into the Tao Te Ching? How did you approach that book? Because that seems like it's one of the more difficult ones to try and translate because the writing's so weird and kind of mystical in a way.
Yeah, and that one I had the most help with, as I'll explain. So back in 2008, 2009, I went through the hardest time of my life to date. And both changing my ideas, like I moved away from the conservative Christian faith that I spoke about earlier. My ideas were changing and I was going through divorce. And for the first time in my life, my mind was a mess. It was filled with anxiety. Like up till that point, I enjoyed being alone and daydreaming. And I would have what people call a positive self-talk. But going through that time, I was filled with anxiety and negative self-talk. And I would go to the bookstore and comb the aisles, philosophy and self-help, looking for things that would be helpful. And one of the books I found most helpful was the Tao Te Ching. And I read it at that time in a modern translation. And two other books that helped me at that same time were The Manual by Epictetus and The Meditations of Marcus Aurelius. So really all three of those books were important to me at that point in time. And then a few years down the road, I thought, as a book creator, book designer myself, I thought it would be nice to do my own editions of those. And But I obviously can't take a modern translation and publish that. That would be a copyright violation. So what I did was I went through all the old public domain translations that were available of the Tao Te Ching, and found the one that I liked the best of all by a man named Dwight Goddard, who was an expert on Buddhism in the 19-teens, 1920s. I believe he lived in India, I think, for quite a while. And I really loved, his translation. It's a little unique in some ways. But it was done as prose. It was just block paragraphs is how he did his translation. So I took it and broke up the lines into more poetry and added titles to each chapter of it. And initially, when I published that book, I believe it was 2010, I didn't even put my name on it. I just had Tao Te Ching, little credit to Dwight Goddard as the translator. But as time went on and I would reread it over the years, I would see more things I wanted to change. And I ended up making pretty significant changes to the words to make it flow better, in my opinion. And then I put my name on it at that point. But as far as what got me into that, I just reading it is a meditative experience. It calmed my mind just to read that book.
What are some of the main principles that you've taken away from that book that you liked most?
It's been a while, honestly, since I've read it, so not fresh, but just it's about acclimating to the way of nature, or accepting the way things flow, that life is out of our control to a great extent. And when we observe things in nature, they go through processes of being born, growing, maturing, declining, dying, and accepting that rather than fighting against it. I would say that's what I took the most from it.
What got you into Emerson?
It's going back to high school would be the first time I was introduced to Emerson in 11th grade. And at that time I was very conservative and thought, I don't like this guy at all, because he's talking about we need a revolution in thought. We need new ideas and come up with our own unique ideas rather than relying on the past. And at that time I believed we need to rely on the past and look to the scriptures and the Bible and such. So, but even though I disagreed with him, I was blown away by his ability to write. He creates so many memorable sentences and phrases. Like, just one example is the shot heard round the world. That phrase, everyone knows that phrase now. He's the one who came up with that phrase to describe the start of the Revolutionary War. So he even coined the term self-help, which we
Oh,
now talk
really?
about. We talk about self-help books. He wrote that the self-helping man is ever welcome. So that's where that phrase comes from.
Yeah, it is
And
kind of funny, like some of the ideas that he had. It really, I mean, it seems like almost all the self-help is derivative of many of the ideas that he had back then.
So going back to the stage where I was going through a difficult time and looking through self-help and philosophy books, that's what I found, is that everything worthwhile in the self-help books was actually in Emerson already. And that's where I really became drawn to his ideas. And he had also gone through a similar deconversion experience where he was a pastor. He started off being a minister, and when he realized he could no longer believe in and follow the old traditions, that's when he decided to give up that job, which was a big thing for him. That was his whole livelihood at that time.
Do you want to give I guess a little Emerson 101 or summary of him, just for people who are unfamiliar, and even me, because I'm still like only kind of familiar.
Sure. So one thing that interests me is just how the central place he was born into and are held in American culture, because he was born in 1803, but But his grandfather was actually a chaplain during the Revolutionary War, and his grandfather was present at the when shots were fired on the Concord Bridge, which was
Right.
the start of the Revolutionary War. And though he grew up in a poor family, his father died when he was young, but he was able to go to Harvard and train to become a minister. And as I said, he could no longer believe the old traditions, so he struck out on his own as a lecturer mainly, and a writer as well. And he's important for creating an American philosophy, really. Up till that point, everything was just reading and relying on the philosophers of Europe. And Emerson was one of the first and loudest voices to say, we need to start over. We're in a new land. We have new surroundings, new ways of doing things, that we should have our own original relationship to culture, basically rethink everything from the ground up because we're in this new land. So that's why he became so central to founding American culture. And he went on to influence so many people, like Walt Whitman, the great American poet, was just completely influenced by Emerson. And you can see trace back everything he wrote in Song of Myself about, yeah, that all was inspired by Emerson. He influenced Emily Dickinson, probably the other great American poet of that time. And he influenced Abraham Lincoln and met with him before the Civil War and encouraged him to release the freeing the slaves. He encouraged Lincoln in that direction. And he was alive during the Civil War, so that whole period. And he wrote, he was very, he became louder over time in fighting slavery and civil
You're right.
injustices and arguing against the Fugitive Slave Act. That was one of his big activities in the 1850s. So then he died in the 1880s. So basically he was alive for the whole formative period of America and became such a central figure because of that, his desire to create an American philosophy.
What were some of the differences between that philosophy and the philosophy that was existing in Europe at the time?
Well, I would say first off, what he grew up surrounded by was Calvinism and, very conservative Christianity based on the writings of Calvin and the reformers, Martin Luther. And that was one of the main things he set out against when he began his career as a young man. But it developed into, even in terms of the Bible, he would say, yeah, those writers, the people who wrote the Bible, and they were of their time and place, and they had a connection of inspiration, perhaps from the divine. But he said, we today can have just as pure a connection to the divine, so we can write our own Bibles.
Yeah, I mean that had to be a very disruptive idea. How was that initially received?
He was roundly condemned. He gave a speech to that effect at Harvard Divinity School. I believe it was 1836 or 1837, and he was banned from Harvard for something like 40 years after delivering that speech.
That's
He
crazy.
wasn't welcome back until the 1870s. Because Harvard at that time was a very conservative Christian institution.
Yeah, it's wild though, like to have a ban for that law. Like, what did they use to justify the ban? Just, we don't
I
like
don't know.
him.
He just upset the dean. He upset the dean too much with his ideas. They certainly considered his ideas dangerous, They thought it would lead people away from Christianity and into immorality.
Yeah.
But he was not an anti-Christian person. Yeah, he re certainly respected and praised the figure of Jesus, but he believed that when Jesus is deified into a God above us, that that actually devalues the teachings of Jesus.
Why is that?
Because if Jesus is also human, then his teachings can apply to us as humans,
Right.
and we can be inspired by his model and attempt to follow it. But he asserted that if Jesus is seen as this divine being or demigod, then we can say, oh, those things he said only apply to him. They don't actually apply to us.
Right. Yeah,
Well,
so
like
it made
what?
it like a little
Yeah.
bit more realistic for people to look up to as a model instead of like this thing that you'd never be able to touch.
Yeah. So when Jesus says things like the kingdom of God is within you, Emerson would say that applies to all of us,
And then
and not just to Jesus being a divine being, but that we have divinity in us just as much as Jesus did. You know, perhaps he was a pure expression of it, a fuller expression, but he was not fundamentally a different sort of being than we are.
yeah. Isn't that what he was saying back then, or at least what some people think that he was saying? Not that he was saying that he was that different, but my understanding is that a lot of, I guess, the mythology around Jesus kind of came after he died, and that like
Yes.
he, like
Yeah.
while he was talking to people, he wasn't acting as if he was like a different kind of thing than everybody else. Is that right?
Right. A lot of people believe that. A lot of people would
Okay.
say that. But the only record we have of Jesus is the Gospels, which were written, you know, decades after his death. And the last of the Gospels to be written is the Gospel of John. In that one, Jesus speaks completely different from the others, and there he says more things along the line that he is the only divine being. So that sort of teaching became more pronounced as the decades went on.
Why do you think that is?
that's a, just the nature of how religions are founded,
Yeah,
I
that's
think
kind
it
of what it
comes.
seems like.
If you look at George Washington, you know, after he died, stories began to accumulate that he never lied,
Right.
that Washington never lied, and miraculous stories surrounding George Washington would accumulate over the decades.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems like we have this weird inclination to like to try and like put people up on a pedestal afterwards and like boost them more up than they even did themselves at the time. Like there are some interesting things about Lao Tzu that people started saying afterward. The Buddha, I guess it depends on who you ask, but my understanding in
Yeah.
Zen is that like they don't see him as something different, but some of the other schools of Buddhism view him as like more of like a god to be worshipped. And it kind of seems like that's I'm no
Yeah.
biblical scholar, but it kind of seems like that's what happened with Jesus, and like that's a little bit what Emerson was pointing at and trying to get people to see, is like everybody kind of has that within them.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And a lot of Westerners and Americans, we have sort of a different view of Buddhism, and we think of it as a philosophy, but there are large sects and numbers of Buddhists who do treat it as a religion, worshiping their god
Yeah.
of Buddha. And even some Taoists would worship Lao Tzu and say that he was a god. But
Yeah. Wow.
when we read the Tao Te Ching, we don't think about that or care about it. We
No.
look for how does this benefit me?
Right.
So that's how I would look at the Bible or the Gospels, is what in this can benefit me.
Yeah. How long did it take for some of those ideas from him to get adopted? Because it seems like. Like you mentioned with Harvard, whenever somebody comes out with something that disruptive against a bunch of groups who have kind of decided on a certain way of interpreting and formulating things, like it seems like it's really difficult to break through that, but he was able to do it.
Yeah, I think there was just a change among the religious leaders of the time. It basically takes the old ones dying off and new ones
Yeah.
rising up to power. But even today, it's not like Emerson's ideas are accepted. There's always such a variety of views and debates. We have in America today a big revival of religious fundamentalism. There are plenty of, the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, saying that, if you want to know my worldview, he said, read the Bible. I believe everything the Bible says. So there's always a variety of views, and that's why Emerson remains relevant to me and fresh, because the debates still go on.
And so willing to like look at each thing and try to decide what what he thinks about each specific piece instead of making a sweeping claim like I believe everything that's in there. And, I'm not trying to bash the Bible, but I mean to say that that you believe everything that's in there, like there's kind of some wild things that they say. And like so like it's kind of it's a weird it seems like there's a weird like combination in there of like the metaphysics and then also the social order, like how people wanted to structure things. And then the problem is like when you try to say that like the whole thing is written by God and you can't question any of it, then it seems like that's like you get kind of caught in a weird trap. And I think most people wouldn't want to there are obviously great things in there, but I think most people wouldn't want to like live with some of the things that are in there that it seems like were more indicative of the times. But he was like ever since he was way more willing to kind of like pick each thing one by one. And is that because of this view that Jesus wasn't a demigod, that he was just a human, so like that takes the I guess the divine touch out of it, so that you're able to like be willing to question some of the ideas.
And believing that we each have access to inspiration. That it's not just that there was a small number of people in the past who were inspired by God, and then that period of time ended, and we have to solely look back and rely on what they wrote. He believed we each have a connection to God. We can each find inspiration. And what you were saying about taking the, well, what I grew up with, what I was taught in my church, was that every word of the Bible is inspired by God and infallible. And what that does is it really puts every verse in the Bible on an equal footing. So you might have like love your neighbor as yourself and turn the other cheek. That is put on equal footing with verses where God is commanding the Israelites to slaughter the Amalekites, slaughter every man, woman, and child. And that's what becomes untenable, is when it's all put on an equal footing. Because there's such a fear of using our own judgment to discern what is correct, what's moral, what am I going to do. There's a fear that whenever you rely on your own judgment, you're going to go astray. And that was what, so one of Emerson's main themes is that we can and should rely on our own judgment.
Why do you think we have that? It seems like it's almost kind of a discomfort or a fear with trusting ourselves that like we so badly want to be able to like point at somebody else and just be like, okay, like you take care of it, like I'll just do what you say. Like why do you think that is?
Well, it is a messy process. Like right now, the phrase "do your own research" is popular because, well, I did my research and I believe that Hillary Clinton is sucking the blood of babies in the bottom of a Walmart.
Fair enough.
So people can be easily manipulated and led astray, and so this relying on our own judgment is a pretty complicated topic in a lot of ways. So Emerson was talking about this very meditative process where he would be out walking in nature and clearing his mind and receiving insights. That's very different from scouring the dark corners of the internet. But even so, people can have wacky ideas, but at the end of the day, we all have to trust our own judgment. Even if I say, well, I believe my judgment is faulty, so I can only trust, this book, that's still my own judgment.
So was he open to people doing that and just saying, I don't know, I like my judgment right now is I'm just gonna like let them take care of it, or did he really encourage people to kind of reinvent the wheel?
I would guess so. I can't think of a specific example at the moment, but he was certainly highly educated, and he did tell people to read, for example, read the classic books. He was very big on Plato and Shakespeare. And so he wasn't really saying, start from scratch with no education, no nothing.
Sure.
He did value the past, and he wrote that, the past is one, that's one area for wisdom and knowledge to come. Our own inspiration is another. So he wouldn't completely exclude the past and history and research.
How literate was the public back then? Because even I like I pick up a lot of original texts, and I really am not very confident that I know what they're saying. Like the Bible, I'm like that. The Tao Te Ching, I'm like, even though I've spent more time with that than any other of the ancient texts, but even some of the like the Hindu scriptures, they're some of them are difficult, and I wonder like how well people were able to interpret those back then, because it seems like even now most of my thinking comes from somebody like yourself who's kind of acted as a mediator for me to understand the original stuff.
Yeah. And I don't know exactly, but people did grow up hearing the King James Bible. That was the main book that would be in every home or most homes in America at that time. So they were used to a more higher difficult style of language. And it is amazing that Emerson became sort of a rock star of his time with he traveled the country giving hundreds and hundreds of lectures. And he would attract crowds and was very well received. Even though he was not a flashy speaker, he would get up there and speak quietly, and people really had to be quiet and listen to hear what he was saying. And a lot of people would come away remarking that, they didn't know exactly what he meant, but it sure was beautiful the way he said
Definitely.
it. So, yeah, I don't know exactly how literate people were, but that. Most people who at least could read would be reading the Bible and Shakespeare, I think, were the dominant things. So,
How influenced was he by Eastern ideas? Because like this idea that God or the divine is inside of us, that seems like, especially back then, like a uniquely Eastern idea compared to some of the Western religions.
yeah, I think he came, I believe he came to that insight on his own initially. And then as years went by, he began reading some of the Eastern classic texts. And Emerson could not read Sanskrit, but he read German. So he would read German translations of Eastern texts. I believe that his good friend Henry David Thoreau could read Sanskrit, and he might have been the first American to be able to read it.
Because
And
he
so
was big on
he,
the Gita, right?
yeah, Thoreau, yeah. So he would share that with Emerson. But Emerson would read it in a German translation. So Emerson did become very influenced by Eastern ideas, especially beginning in the 1840s and later, I would say. There's an excellent book called Emerson and the Light of India, and it's one of the best books I've read about Emerson, and it goes into great depth with that.
That's cool. Where did he like? Do you know how he came up with or verified his ideas? Because like some of his ideas are more stripped down and I guess more empirical, and some of them were a little bit more abstract, and you're kind of taking a leap of faith. Like he seemed to balance both of those. Like, do you know how he came to his beliefs in general?
His own intuition was
Yeah, and he
really
just,
his
okay.
guide. With what he wrote, he was very big on the idea of self-evident truths, which is one of the things I
Okay.
like about him. Like, again, how American Emerson is, we have that phrase, "These are self-evident truths" in the Declaration of Independence. And I would say everything Emerson wrote, he tried to write it in a way that it was self-evident and that he wouldn't need to argue it or provide footnotes and say, well, you should believe this because it comes from, Kant's Critique of Pure Reason, Chapter 3, blah, blah, blah. So he was not a writer who used footnotes. It was he tried to phrase things so clearly that it would be, oh yeah, I can see how that's true. So that's something I really like about him.
What do you think about his opinion on studying nature more diligently rather than just like enjoying being out in it? Like he seemed to like in Everyday Emerson, you talk about like how at least the impression that I got was that he was emphatic on studying, the natural sciences.
Yeah, when he was younger, he wanted to become a scientist. And he read the latest scientific works of the day. So Thoreau as well, he would know all the Latin name of every plant that he walked past, and he would really study and journal and log all the little developments in nature. And Emerson believed that that when we study and learn about nature, we learn about ourselves. Because he believed that everything in nature has a corollary in the mind. So, for example, he talked about when you mix two plants together, crossbreeding, and it creates a hardier version. He said that's like mixing two streams of thought in our mind to create a hardier idea. So that was part of his obsession with nature, is that he believed everything that could be studied scientifically would reveal something about his own mind. And it's a difficult concept to grasp sometimes.
Like he had that idea that I think it was mind creates matter. Is that like roughly?
Yes.
What do you think about that idea? Could you explain that?
And he was inspired there by Plato and others, the idealist school of philosophy that puts mind first. And even in Eastern philosophy and religion, you'll hear life is a dream or an illusion. And for Emerson, it's really this idea that consciousness and mind are that's the fundamental thing, and matter is an expression or manifestation of it. And scientifically, that was just considered lunacy at the time. Where they believed everything was matter. And, up the early 1900s and such, it would be, well, if you get enough matter together in a complex form, it will somehow become conscious and magically create a mind. But with quantum physics, there's a return back to this idea that where scientists are discovering that consciousness is fundamental with quantum physics. And I enjoy reading books about that stuff. I don't claim to understand it very
I don't
well,
understand it at all.
but I think that's the idea that some of these thinkers have and that Emerson agreed with, is that everything is consciousness. Everything, the only thing that exists is consciousness, and our whole experience of reality is happening within the realm of consciousness.
Where do you sit on that spectrum personally between like idealism and materialism?
I certainly find Emerson very compelling, and these things with quantum physics I've read about, I find very compelling and enjoyable. So I agree with that idea that consciousness is primary, but I don't claim to know everything about it or understand it. I will say I was very interested in the question of evolution for a while because I grew up conservative Christian, we were taught God created the whole world in 6 days. And so as I got older and began reading about evolution, at first it was a scary idea that, humans evolved from earlier creatures that seemed to make us no longer special. But then the more I learned about it and became convinced, I saw how amazing that is, that all life is connected. We all, and just how amazing it is, it starting from a single cell, that could evolve into more complex organisms. But reading the hardcore Darwinist authors like Richard Dawkins and Jerry Coyne, people like that, I was not convinced by them that everything is matter, that this is purely a physical process, that genetic random genetic mutation and selection or survival of the fittest, that that's all it takes. So I've been more convinced by people who believe that there's a spiritual element to it, that there has to be a greater force driving evolution. And I see it as that it's a process from within. I don't believe in the old man God in the sky, micromanaging evolution, tooling and engineering things, but I believe it's a spiritual process that is self-manifesting as time goes on. And yeah, that's one example where I believe consciousness is greater than matter or driving matter.
So you think that evolution is more purposeful than random?
Yes. Yeah, that's just my belief. I'm not a biologist. I'm not an
Yeah,
expert
neither.
on it. I just enjoy reading books. There's a biologist named Rupert Sheldrake. Have you heard of him? I love his stuff. So I love his writings.
Yeah, I've heard a little bit about him. He did was he the one who was talking about morphic resonance?
Yes.
Yeah, do you want to touch on some of his ideas a little bit? Because I've heard his name and I've heard of the concept. I talked about it with a guest, but I'm not very familiar with him.
Sure. So again, not being a biologist, my impression is, for example, every life begins as one cell with a set of DNA that divides. Every cell contains the same DNA. So how do certain cells know to become bone cells or heart cells or brain cells? And what causes creatures to take the form and shape that they do? And Rupert Sheldrake is this British biologist who came up with a theory that there are fields, an energetic field, some might say a spiritual field. He called it a morphic field that determines the form that cells take and creatures take as they develop. And he also believed these fields change and evolve, and as things move in a certain direction, it becomes easier for things to move in that direction. And one of the most fascinating things he talks about is if, for example, he says it, and he points to studies on this. I don't have the studies in front of me, so I can't cite it, but if rats learn to navigate a particular maze in one part of the world, in a lab on the other side of the world, rats will learn more quickly how to navigate the same maze
That's
because
crazy.
he believes there's a telepathic connection between all beings, and that
That's
when
wild.
something, yeah, when, and we see that in human evolution, you have populations separated all over the world. People start building pyramids in one part of the world, pyramids start going up in another part of the world. And so, yeah, that's my understanding of morphic resonance in a nutshell.
So I've heard some people who will talk about like this idea that with creative ideas, like sometimes it's just their time to come through and
Yeah.
like that can pop up anywhere. It's not like it's not even necessarily dependent on the person. It's just like the idea just kind of drops in wherever it drops in, and sometimes it's in multiple places. So like he
Right.
is that kind of his view that it's just like there's this like greater thing at play that's influencing the way that we think and the kinds of things that we do, and that's how you see like rapid and similar developments culturally in various parts of the world that don't have communication with each other.
Yes, yeah, I think that's what he would say. And we see so many examples of it. Yeah.
Well, Darwin was kind of an example with that, wasn't he? Like, weren't there like multiple people? And even Emerson, I think you had said like had come up with the idea kind of like not a specific about survival and reproduction, but like it seemed like those ideas were kind of bubbling in various parts of the
Yeah.
world.
Yeah, the concept of evolution and that all creatures had come from one or several common ancestors. That idea was bubbling up all over. And even Darwin's grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, wrote a book or a poem about that.
Oh,
And
wow.
Emerson wrote a poem about it in his book, Nature, imagining everything starting from a worm and this worm climbing up the stairs until it becomes a human. And Darwin's real contribution was to say this can all be attributed to diversity, like mutations, basically, and then natural selection or survival of the fittest, and also sexual selection, like which mates reproduce, which are chosen, and such. So Darwin's contribution was the natural selection piece of it, and to say that explains everything, which I don't believe that explains everything. I'm more convinced by authors who say there are other factors at play, including things we don't even know about yet.
I kind of hope so. It's kind of
Yeah.
cooler if there's like some of the, some of the more abstract ideas, if those are true, especially with the stuff with quantum physics. I'm not even going to pretend to roughly understand what's going on, but like I know like some, like the one where like you look at the thing and it moves whether or not you're looking at it. Like some of that is it, that stuff's way over my head, but I've heard like some people who are a lot smarter in it than I am who have talked about those ideas. It's fascinating.
Right, the finding that experiments are changed depending on whether they're observed, and sort of the answer doesn't come into being, doesn't resolve itself until a consciousness focuses on it to
That's
determine the
crazy.
answer. Right.
So with the American scholar, a lot of us, I think like often we'll think about intellectuals as people who just kind of like sit around and think a lot and like just like only read or write or like quote unquote like armchair philosophers and stuff like that. But he seemed to be like a lot more he seemed to believe strongly that it was important for like people to go out and like do like go out into the world and do stuff, especially physical labor. Is that what do you think about those ideas about like getting out of the box a little bit?
I love those ideas. I think our schools should be much more built that way, like not having students, especially the younger ones. Well, even the older ones, not having people just sitting in chairs all day listening to lectures.
Like we don't do anything.
But yeah, get out there, get your hands dirty, build things and grow things. I think that as much as I hate yard work, I love that idea of Emerson's.
I mean, I can't stand it, but like I hear that more and more, especially from some of the ancients. Like I think even Marcus Aurelius, like he would go out and do stuff, like he would hawk or whatever, and it seems like that was common among more of the people back then. I may be wrong about that, but that's kind of the impression that I'm getting. But it seems like there are definitely limits to like only like sitting around and thinking.
Oh, I'm a big believer in that more exercise should be in school too. And they do things in such a horrible way. Like when I was in school, they had recess where you just stand around doing nothing. And then in 7th and 8th grade, we were thrown into gym class where we're suddenly doing Greco-Roman wrestling.
You did
And
wrestling?
yeah.
Oh,
And
wow.
I was the weakest kid in the class. I got paired with the other weak kid and he whooped me badly. So it was a just horrible embarrassment. And we would go from, so you have no exercise in school, then suddenly in 7th grade they made us run around the football field. And I literally threw up after I ran around the football field because I had never run that far before. So I believe there should be a lot more exercise in school from the very beginning. More There should be more of it and more guided and for fun rather than competition.
Well, in that case, then, to be fair to the schools, I think we've gotten a little bit better than with that because we exercised quite a bit when I was in elementary school and stuff, but we never got to do wrestling. I feel like we never would have been allowed to have physical contact like that.
I remember I was at home and I would practice my opening move, like just imagining doing it on the kid. And when the day of my match came, I did that one opening move. I got him down, and then he rolled over and just whooped me. That's all I could do was the opening move.
Do you have any practices or routines or anything like that that you like to go to implement some of Emerson's ideas?
I walk a lot
Yeah.
in forests. I live in Nashville and we have some really nice parks and forests here. So that's when I feel the most like Emerson, is every day I'll go out and walk in the forest.
Yeah, that's cool.
And I like the idea of meditation. I haven't been very good at practicing it as far as sitting there silent in a room, but Emerson didn't really do that either. I'd say his meditation was walking and then reading. So that's what I do, walking and reading.
Yeah, I bounce around between those three. It doesn't really seem to be that important which one you pick, but with walking seems to be unique in like the way that it makes my brain feel. Especially if it's nice out, and especially if you can get into nature. Like there's definitely benefits to meditation where you kind of completely shut down the stimulus outside, but there is something different about walking where I feel like my best ideas come when I'm out wandering around.
Yeah. And I see the appeal of meditation because I've had experiences where I'll sit still and meditate. It takes me, after about a half hour or 45 minutes, there will come a feeling of expansion and floating, and then it'll be whoa, and then I snap out of it. So I can see that if I practiced enough to let that state happen and to stay in it, that it could be amazing. But I haven't had the discipline for it because it takes 45 minutes of just sitting there.
But I've had some weird experiences, and because sometimes I've just like strapped myself down to the cushion with a cough or whatever just to see what would happen. I was like, all right, well, let me stay here for as long as I need to. And you do get some pretty interesting experiences, but I am garbage at keeping them with me. Like I'm just not very good at making it last. I feel like I get popped out of it pretty fast. But there's definitely good benefits to it in my experience.
Yeah, the thing I do a lot that Emerson would not have done is listening to meditation tracks. And whether it's binaural beats or guided meditations or certain frequency tones, I've experimented with all that stuff. So when I lay down to go to sleep, I'll usually put on either some relaxing meditative album or something like a particular tone to fall asleep. So that's my form of meditation. But sitting there in just total silence with nothing is a that's tough.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on binaural beats? I haven't tried that one, but I do hear that it's a good route.
I've used them a little bit. Yeah, I don't. It's hard to say. I would definitely recommend it to people with insomnia to try those sorts of things. I think it can really help you go to sleep. So I haven't noticed a particular benefit from it, like a lasting change of mental state that has stayed with me. I haven't noticed that.
So, what have you been working on lately?
I'm kind of in between projects. I worked for 6 years on a graphic novel, and it's called The Dirty Parts of the Bible, and it's a fictional adventure story. I wrote the original prose version years ago and then decided to turn it into a comic book or graphic novel version. And I hired an artist to do the final illustrations, but I sketched out every page. Like I wrote the script and drew really, really rough sketches for every page. And I found the most amazing artist, Tina Ritchie, who drew the whole thing. But this was. I thought about that book every day for 6 years. Even though I wasn't working on it every day, but I thought about it. And even some of the other books, like the Emerson books I've written, were written at the same time I was working on that. So it's not like it was my whole thing. But it was finally published November last year. So right now I'm just kind of dealing with life things and recovering from that. And I'm focused on selling it, like marketing it. And I have some vague ideas, but I haven't started another big project yet.
Well, do you like having multiple things bouncing around at once? Like make multiple ideas instead of just locking in on only one.
That's hard to say because I've done both and enjoyed both. So it's hard to pick. I will say a lot of times I'll just spend months thinking about an idea and it's just slowly gestating.
Yeah.
And even years of vague idea taking form. And then when it's time, I'll sit down and knock it out in a month. That's
Yeah.
typically what I do. And
Yeah. That makes me feel good to hear, because I'll do that too sometimes. Like I'll feel like I sometimes I try to like push things out when they're half baked and it doesn't usually go well. And other times, like I find times where I'm like I'm thinking about something for a long time, but it just like doesn't feel like it's time for it to come yet. Like, do you have that? Is that usually what it's like for you? Okay.
And there are a lot of writers who will say, "Oh, you need to force yourself to sit down every day and write." That's just not my way of doing things.
Yeah.
I will more ponder it. For example, the book Living from the Soul, that which is my favorite of the books I've done about Emerson, Living from the Soul. I had that idea. The seed of the idea goes back to around 2009. And I was initially thinking, oh, I'd like to do a book with quotes from the Tao Te Ching and Marcus Aurelius and Epictetus and tie these quotes together somehow. And then I started really getting into Emerson and thinking, oh, I could tie him into this project. And then I came across a journal entry that Emerson wrote in 1833, I believe, where he stated his principles. And it basically, he wrote seven principles down. And when I read that, I realized what he says is so a lot is in line with exactly what I wanted to quote from the Tao Te Ching and Epictetus and Marcus Aurelius, that if I use that journal entry as the outline for the book, I could tie it all together.
That's cool.
So that book really, it grew from that vague seed for 10 years. And then I sat down and did it in a I think it took 3 months probably to do that book,
Nice.
but it had been growing 10 years. So there's a lot of value in just write down your little seed ideas. I keep a journal of those and just let it grow in the back of your mind till it's ready.
Yeah, that's comforting to hear. I feel like at this point I'm too infected by the Tao Te Ching to make myself try to like force stuff out. I feel like one of my bigger influences is Rick Rubin, and that's his favorite book. He's the one who got me into the Tao Te Ching in the first place, and like he'll talk about that too, about like not forcing stuff out, even though it's like it's kind of hard, especially like if you're a beginner. Like sometimes you feel like you want to like rip the skin off the snake, so to speak.
There, have you heard of The Artist's Way,
Yeah, I
that
have.
book?
I haven't read that, but I've heard it's a good one.
Yeah, by Julia Cameron. So the main lesson from that book is she says to write 3 pages by hand every morning, stream of consciousness. And I actually started doing that toward the end of last year, kept it up for probably 3 months, and I've fallen out of the habit lately. But I did find that was very helpful for starting the day on the right track. But it's not about, you're not trying to write anything good or worthwhile. It's just literally write anything that comes to mind. And I could see how that would help prime the pump to sort of keep you ready for when you're ready to start an actual serious project and write something worthwhile. So journaling, I think, is great. I wish I did it more. I'll go through spurts of doing it.
Me too.
So I highly recommend journaling though.
Yeah, so I'll have the Tao Te Ching linked, and then the Emerson books and this graphic novel too. Outside of that,
Great.
along with your website and stuff, outside of that, is there anything else that you'd like to let people know about?
That's it. Yeah, like I said, the graphic novel is the main thing I'm working on selling now, so I appreciate you mentioning it. And my website has everything that's needed.
Cool. Well, thanks a lot for coming on. I really appreciate your time today.
Yeah, thank you. And I admire what you're doing. It's such a great idea as a
Thanks.
student to start a podcast and be able to connect with people that way.
Yeah. It's been a lot of fun so far. Like there's been so many interesting people that for some reason have been willing to come on, like yourself. It's so cool to to meet so many different people and talk about these ideas and stuff. It's been a lot of fun.
That's great. And you're majoring in psychology or philosophy?
Psychology, yeah. Even
Okay,
though,
nice. I've got
frankly,
yeah.
I'm a little bit. I've been more interested in the philosophy route lately. It's a little late to switch, but yeah. The major psychology, although like many of my most recent podcasts have been in the philosophy world.
Oh, nice. I've actually got a son who's a psychology major at University of Tennessee, Knoxville.
Oh, cool.
So that's fun. Yeah, I love learning about psychology myself and admire, people who are studying it. So,
Yeah.
yeah,
Cool. Well,
great
yeah.
to meet you.
Thanks a lot. You too. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Have a great day.
You too.